Another day with these old statues. So what are we doing today?
Remove statue of Thomas Starr King from California pedestal in the statuary hall. Prepare for shipping back to California and place in storage.
Thomas Starr King. Never heard of him. Plaque says, born 1824, died 1864. Sure died young.
Wonder what he did to get his statue in here. Maybe found a ton of gold in 1849?
Or got rich building railroads or ships carrying the 49ers. Whoever he was, nobody knows who he is now.
When I picked up a brochure about the Starr King School of Ministry, the Unitarian Universalist Seminary in Berkeley, California, I imagined that it was named for a Mr. Starr and a Mr. King, who probably gave millions for its establishment. I was wrong. I read more and found out it was named for one man, a Unitarian minister, Thomas Starr King from Boston. Then how did his statue come to represent California in the National Statuary Hall? Why did Abraham Lincoln call him the orator who saved the Union? The brochure raised many questions for me, including whether Starr King has a message for me today, almost 200 years after his birth.
Today, we explore the life and times of Starr King, hear his story in his own writing and oratory, as well as the words of family, friends, colleagues, and others. In our presentation, Helen Bishop will be the voice of Starr King. Other readers take on the voices and roles of various characters shown in your program.
During the 19th century, the United States was beginning the long transition from rural to urban, from agrarian to industrial, from English colony to world power. This transition was reflected in the political, social, religious, and intellectual life of the new country, with New England playing a large role. Abolition of slavery, suffrage for women, safety and wages for adults and children, opportunities for immigrants, and campaigns against demon rum were issues simmering during this time. Such issues echo in today's news.
These social issues were also reflected in discussions about religion. Was religion a list of rules for living out a battle between good and evil for people's souls as believed by those called traditionalists? Or was religion a guide for living in harmony with other people as held by liberal Christians, including some Congregationalists, Unitarians, Universalists, who yet had theological arguments among and between themselves? Into the tension of 19th century America, Starr King was born, lived, and preached. He was friend and colleague of the literary and religious giants of the day. What led Starr King to abandon the safety and comfort of home and friends in Boston and to seek a new frontier in the wilds of 1860 California? Therein lies our story.
My son, Starr, was studious, good-natured boy, although always frail and frequently sick with the rheumy. He often disappeared for hours into the woods and was fascinated by the plants and animals that attracted his attention. He loved being in church to hear his father preach, or just to sit by himself in contemplation. I always wondered what he was thinking about. My husband, Reverend King, accepted the pulpit at the Charlestown, Massachusetts Universalist Church when Starr was 11 years old. Starr was enrolled in grammar school and began classical education. Schoolmaster Bates tutored him for matriculation at college. Alas, that was not to be. My husband fell ill suddenly and died in 1839. At age 15, Starr took work as a clerk at the naval yard to support me and five younger children. He never complained that his dream of college and a life of scholarship was so suddenly taken away from him. He was a good and faithful son.
Despite not being able to attend college, Starr continued reading and discussing ideas that he found compelling with professors at nearby Harvard and with preachers from many creeds. He was especially engaged with preachers espousing liberal Christianity and with friends who regularly gathered for theological discussion.
I enjoyed my accounting work at the Naval Yard, but I hoped for a situation that was more in line with my interests. At the age of 18, I took a place as grammar school teacher, which bettered the financial circumstances for my family. I also had the time and the good fortune of regularly conversing with the Reverend Hosea Ballou, a Universalist who challenged my theological ideas. I never tired of talking with and listening to all the learned men around Harvard and Boston, such as Professors Walker and Silliman, Reverend Chapin, and Dr. William Henry Channing. I felt less affinity for the Reverend Theodore Parker, him being too fiery for me.
You were particularly drawn to philosophical texts, which you seemed to understand with ease. Even the most difficult passage from Immanuel Kant, you grasped immediately and explained to us at tutorial.
I read Hegel and Kant and all the Greek philosophers. Some philosophies were near my own beliefs, but one philosophy has done much harm for the religious world, namely the insincere expressions of high ideals and extreme piety. I wish to rid myself of the poison and earnestly desire to free all pulpits and meetings from it.
I remember when you wrote about meeting a famous phrenologist who analyzed bumps on your skull for clues to your abilities and prospects. Based on his analysis, the phrenologist concluded that you should study law due to your low level of conscientiousness and your high level of combativeness and destructiveness.
I asked him if ministry would be a suitable profession for me. He said, no, it would not be a good choice. Finally, he admitted that if I were to become a minister, it could only be in the doctrine of thoroughgoing universalism.
At age 20, Starr King began preaching in various pulpits in the Boston area and wrote treatises which received attention from liberal theologians. He maintained friendships and correspondence with an array of the best-known and highly regarded ministers and scholars. At age 26, as a result of study, discourse, and writing, Starr King was awarded an honorary degree by Harvard. His growing reputation moved him toward his goal of the ministry. With his many gifts and early associations, it was natural that King should choose the Christian ministry as his permanent vocation, or perhaps it chose him. He took no regular course of theological training. He did not seem to require any. He carefully trained his naturally rich and powerful voice under the best instructors, and this made him one of the most impressive and beautiful speakers and readers I had ever heard. Reverend Theodore Parker recommended him for several placements. Finally, the Charlestown Universalist Church called him, the same church his father had served. It was a difficult post which exhausted him and brought about a recurrence of the respiratory problems he had experienced in childhood. As a result, he took a long sailing trip to the Azores for rest and recuperation. Upon his return, he answered the call to a larger congregation in Boston, Hollis Street Unitarian Church. The change of denomination from Universalist to Unitarian was not without comment from Universalists in the area. The two denominations had continuing, and at times bitter, theological quarrels about the nature of God, sin, grace, and salvation, as well as perceived differences in social status.
Universalists think God is too good to condemn them forever. Unitarians think they are too good to be damned forever. Unitarians and Universalists have not united because they are really too near of kin to be married.
His pastoring emphasized quick and tender sympathy for members of the congregation, as well as for the poor, the distressed, and unfortunate. While at Hollis Street, Starr married Miss Julia Wiggins, a gracious hostess and helpmate in the ministry, and became a father with the birth of daughter Edith.
Starr King continued to develop and refine his rhetoric and presentation. From his own words in sermons and letters, we hear what he believed about his work and his views on the role of church and clergy in society.
I would insist as strongly as anyone on the right and duty of ministers to act as reformers, to speak in anti-slavery meetings and temperance and peace meetings. Let them act as reformers in the proper sphere for such social action, and in the pulpit, let them attack the central throne of sin in the private heart.
Starr King, on Unitarian preaching, in a letter reporting a conversation with the son of John Quincy Adams, Charles Francis Adams, and his wife.
Mr. Adams complained to me, "Unitarian preaching is too cold, too clear, rational, and explanatory. It is too moral. It derives too little inspiration from the great religious principles of the New Testament. Everywhere I hear the same complaint. The trouble is not with the essential principles of liberal Christianity. The trouble is with the preachers. We may keep all our philosophy and still preach with fervor. What intellectual conception is so grand and so elevating as that of the infinite being, the architect of nature, creator of suns and firmaments, who also loves humanity? The need is not to go back to the mysteries of orthodoxy, which paralyze and offend the intellect. The essential principles of liberal Christianity can revive the world when preachers proclaim them with joy and fervor." Mrs. Adams, on the other hand, thought ministers ought to pepper their sermons with more terrors, the fear of eternal damnation.
Starr King on faith, reason, and the transcendental nature of religion.
Faith in man implies the dignity of human nature. Reason, instead of being subordinated to faith, is the very essence of faith, or else faith is just blind idolatry. You, my friend Randolph, desire the manifestation of Christianity as the means of raising the individual. I look rather to the elevation of the individual as the one great means of improving society.
King did not shrink from speaking on the controversial topics, such as the Dred Scott decision or the Fugitive Slave Act, by which runaway slaves were forcibly returned to their owners. One incident involving the return of a slave, Anthony Burns, was recognized as galvanizing the abolition movement in Boston and across New England. Starr King recounts his sermon on the Sunday after Burns was paraded through the streets of Boston by bounty hunters.
The Sunday after his capture, the churches were vocal with strong preaching. I preached on the arrest, trial, and condemnation of Jesus, that judicial process that is so infamous. The features of Jesus' trial correspond to that of poor Burns. The character of the evidence on which Jesus was condemned, the manner of his arrest, the unsuccessful attempt at rescue, the conspiracy of two sets of officers, the courtroom filled with brutal scamps. Unsuccessful efforts to release Jesus refused because Caesar would be offended. The condemnation in Jerusalem on Friday morning at 9 o'clock, the same as here in Boston, and the giving of a new robe to Jesus, as poor Mr. Burns was given a new suit. My words made a great stir that thrilled the majority of the parish and quite enraged the pro-slavery brethren. Some threatened to leave the church, but they were here again yesterday, and I guess I shall triumph. That poor man Burns, by marching down State Street at noon under military guard, made more abolitionists than Theodore Parker made in a year.
Through his sermons and his wide-ranging lecture circuit across New England and into the Midwest, Starr King gained a reputation as a forceful, courageous, and eloquent speaker with a sense of purpose and a sense of humor. These characteristics made him a candidate for pulpits wherever he had spoken. Theodore Parker called Starr King the best preacher in Boston. But it was the call from San Francisco that finally lured him away from Boston to a new congregation, one struggling to become established. Despite many entreaties to stay in Boston, he was steadfast in his desire to move for both the opportunity to serve and to increase his wages to support his family.
We are unfaithful in huddling so closely around the cozy stove of civilization in this blessed Boston. And I, for one, am ready to go out into the cold and see if I'm good for anything.
In April of 1860, when Reverend King, our young daughter Edith, and I left for California, we had little idea about the hardships of travel. 2 weeks in the cold Atlantic, days across the Isthmus of Panama by bus in wretched heat, and at sea again for 2 weeks on the Pacific Ocean. We were crowded below deck as the ship was built and provisioned for 500 travelers, but sailed with 1,000 aboard. We sought to secure food and water and privacy, of which there was little. Everywhere people were seasick or suffering from the food or water available. We heard stories of extortion and outrage over tickets and fares and promises broken. Starr said old Vanderbilt must be a shark packed into human shape, baptized with a Christian name. He ought to be dragged in the sea behind the ship from New York to Panama like a ship mop.
The very day after arrival, Starr King gave his first sermon to a large congregation eager to see their new and well-known pastor. They had expected a great orator, but were disappointed with his first impression.
Could this slender, youthful-looking man with his beardless, boyish face and long, lank hair be the celebrated preacher, Thomas Starr King?
So we were surprised when he turned to us and he spoke. He possessed a marvelous voice, deep and rich with great carrying power. The beauty of his prayers, impressiveness of his scripture reading, and electric quality of his delivery were great attractions.
Soon he was widely known for his oratory and for his work in the community with the poor. He raised $20,000 to pay off the church's debt and another $80,000 for a new building. In all his endeavors, he sought to explain and promote liberal Christianity and took this message to places outside the walls of the church, to missions, orphanages, colored churches, seamen chapels, and with other ministers in an ecumenical spirit, a spirit not always reciprocated.
When souls feel equally the riches of infinite love, though one receives it as a Trinitarian, another as a Calvinist, or Quaker, Catholic, Methodist, or Universalist, you cannot entertain disputes about the size of the window through which they receive their light. But except from all reverence for God, penitent love, joy in the ever-present grace, devotion to humanity, adoration of the infinite spirit, and grateful trust in infinite compassion, these unite us in fellowship of spirit and fly to music for expression.
Starr King's reputation as a lecturer followed him to California and he was soon in demand and accepted invitations far and wide. These travels took him to all parts of California and the Northwest Pacific, from the Sierra Mountains through redwood forest and desert, along the rugged Pacific coast to the south. Everywhere he met with an appreciative hearing and became immensely popular.
During this time, he also changed his rhetorical style, as noted by a newspaper reporter. He polished his sentences less. He waited no longer on fancies. He dropped to good, plain talk during his address. Then, when his hearers were rested, he blazed out with passages that swept away everything except thought of the subject he addressed.
While Star King was enjoying his new state and stature, as well as increased income for a growing family, the political winds on the Pacific coast were stormy. The election of Lincoln in 1860 had brought the issue of slavery to a boil. The divisions were wide, with three factions contesting for the future of California. Those favoring secession, an alliance with the Confederate states, those favoring secession and establishment of an independent Pacific Republic, and those favoring the Union, the national government of the United States, abolition of slavery, and establishment of free states across the breadth of the United States. At the time, the power of the military, newspapers, and political leaders in California strongly sympathized with the secession movement. Lincoln received few electoral votes from California. The Unionists had no one to lead them in arguing for the principles of the Republic as the war began and continued on.
One man on the Pacific coast had the standing, character, training, and power of oratory to present the Union cause, Star King. His lectures and his sermons often drew on the ideas behind the American Revolution and the founding documents which promised civil, personal, and religious freedom. Star King traveled relentlessly and spoke to groups of people on all types of themes, such as the Organization of Liberty on this continent, George Washington and the Union, Daniel Webster and the Constitution, Lexington and the new struggle for liberty. Everywhere, Star King argued the case for the Union. Each place Star King spoke, money was collected for the Union. California raised $1.5 million for the Union, much of it attributed to his lectures, which also garnered many volunteers for soldiers' supply and aid. At a military garrison where he spoke, soldiers who attended were clad in Confederate gray as prescribed by state authorities. As a result of the lecture and money raised, the uniforms were exchanged for Union Blue. As the war went on, King became bolder on the issue of race and against racial prejudice.
Cannonballs are black. War does not whitewash them. Powder is black. War does not bleach it. Why then this absurd prejudice against a race of the same color in their hearts as you and I?
He urged the president to issue the long-rumored and anticipated proclamation ending slavery.
Oh, that the president would soon speak that electric sentence, inspiration to the loyal North, doom to the traitorous aristocracy whose cup of guilt is full. Let him say this is a war of mass against class, of America against feudalism, of the schoolmaster against the slave master, of workmen against the barons, of the ballot box against the barracoon. Proclaim it, and what a light breaks through our leaden sky.
Throughout the years of 1861 to 1864, Starr King was the center of union appeal to the citizens of California, speaking out clearly for the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. For his efforts, he was called the orator who saved California for the Union by President Abraham Lincoln and others. After four long years of rallying Union support throughout California, King settled back in San Francisco for the dedication of the new church. Frail from childhood, often taxed by his unceasing devotion to his ministry and his country, King was exhausted. He dreamed of some time away from the rigorous schedule with travel to Germany and South America, as well as a time to write a book on the California Sierras and another on philosophy. Prophetically, Starr believed that, like his father, he would not survive his 40th year. In 1864, he contracted diphtheria, then pneumonia. A second bout of pneumonia doomed him.
He asked the doctor how much time he had. 1.5 hours, not more. With his wife, daughter, and son at his bed, he dictated his will and bade farewell.
Tell my congregation, I hope they pay the debt on this church, and let the church free from debt be my monument. Tell all that I went lovingly, trustfully, peacefully.
Then he repeated the 23rd Psalm in his clear and resonant voice. That day, 1,000 flags in San Francisco were lowered. The Mint and other government offices were closed. The legislature adjourned for 3 days. When memorial services were held in San Francisco, Starr King was buried on the grounds of the new Unitarian Church. Later, a memorial service at the Hollis Street Unitarian Church in Boston was attended by many friends and colleagues who heard a eulogy by Edward Everett Hale.
A statue of Starr King was erected in Golden Gate Park in 1892 with this inscription by William Cullen Bryant. So let the light stream on his deeds of love that shamed the light of all but heaven. And in the book of fame, the glorious record of his virtues write, and hold it up to all people, and bid them claim a plan like his, and catch from him the hallowed flame. In 1931, a statue of Starr King was placed in the National Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C., in recognition of his importance to the state of California.
Another day in the statuary hall. So, what are we doing today?
Let's see. Install statue of Ronald Reagan on the California pedestal. Remember when we took the statue of the other guy out? Do you remember his name?
I do. His name was Starr King. I Googled him. He lived an amazing life. He was a preacher, a lecturer, and wrote books about Yosemite. People say that he actually saved the Union during the Civil War by giving lectures all over California.
Wow, that's a lot to do in 40 years. I guess that's why he died so young, just wore himself out.
Theodore Parker, a contemporary of Starr King, and a radical Unitarian minister and abolitionist, wrote, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one, My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by my experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends toward justice. The life and ministry of Starr King challenges us as Unitarian Universalists. He spoke fervently about the promise of freedom and equality in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and our responsibility when those principles are threatened. As we look ahead to February, as Social Justice and Black History Month, we might ask, what would Starr King do? Whatever your personal cause may be, when you take a stand and speak out and work together for the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of all people, you bend the arc toward justice and honor the legacy of Starr King. And there ends our story.